Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is a special post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. I'm Anoush Samarodi, host of the podcast Note to Self from WNYC Studios. Tonight, our conversation is about technology. Because the fact that this election came as such a surprise to so many of us shows that we are just starting to wrestle with the powers of social media and algorithms. They are changing how we live, our communities, and how our country functions. We're going to discuss how echo chambers and likes may have affected your vote or whether you decided to vote at all. We'll also talk about the future of digital privacy under President-elect Trump and how we hold on to free speech and basic human rights when so much data is being collected. But let's start off our conversation with a focus on social media. Because going online right now, it can feel like you are wading into the ocean, right? Like you could be going for a quick, refreshing dip, get up to date on the news, or you could get knocked over by a rogue wave of tweets displaying humanity at its absolute worst. We want to hear from you about how you are dealing with social media right now. Have you decided to take the Facebook app off your phone? Are you suffering from information overload right now? Or maybe you've gone the other way. Maybe you cannot tear your eyes away from Twitter, and you are devouring every update about Trump's new appointments, texting everyone you know. So our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's also 212-433-9692. Or you can tweet your comment at WNYC. And before we go to that, I just want to share with you, I asked my listeners this very question about how they are dealing with social media and all this information for today's Note to Self episode. And here is what some of them told me.
I have a friend that I keep in touch with on Facebook that I know is a good person, and we don't talk a lot, but she's a supporter, and it's constantly on my mind thinking about how she's a decent person and this half of the country that doesn't agree with the people in my circle. I just keep remembering there's people like her there too.
When I looked at Twitter, all I saw were comments about how any Trump supporter is actually deep down a racist and that there's no other reason to be glad for the results. And that's not true. I just can't afford health insurance. And it feels like he is listening when everyone else is telling me that they don't see a problem and that the system is working the way it should.
It's hard to know exactly what to do with a lot of the information that I get. And frustratingly, it tends to be super, super liberal because most of my friends are Californians. And so I think to a large degree, I totally fell into the trap where, you know, the media that you're consuming now is to a large degree influenced by your friends.
I stopped having Facebook and Twitter on my phone. In fact, I've actually deleted my personal Twitter account. I found that my own reactions to online discussion and my own contributions to that discourse have really tanked. And I think that reflects the split in your country and beginning to be my country, in Canada. And I think that the online discourse that transpires from that is increasing that growth. And I think it's dividing, you know, in my case, my family.
So social media, it is not just an American phenomenon. So many emotions, dilemmas, and I want to hear from you too. But first, I would like to welcome my guest for this first half hour. Farhad Manju is the technology columnist for the New York Times. His piece today is called Social Media's Globe-Shaking Power, Over the weekend, he wrote about the temptation to quit Twitter. And right after Trump won, he reported that Silicon Valley is reeling after this election. And he is Skyping us from Mountain View in California. I think Mountain View. Hi, Farhad. Yeah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to hear your voice. Are you right by Google's headquarters right now?
I am. I'm like half a mile away.
All right. Well, thank you for being here. So let's start with Google. Farhad, since the election, there's been a lot of pressure on Google, on Facebook, to acknowledge that their algorithms spread articles, information that may or may not be based on fact. And now both companies are saying that they're going to change their advertising policies to explicitly prohibit sites that traffic in fake news from making money off lies. That's a quote from your piece. Is this a big deal or is this just lip service?
I think this is probably for both companies. I think it's a first step in what could be, a longer term push against these fake news sites. I think it's a bigger problem for Facebook than it is for Google, because I actually think Google has been trying to do this for a while sort of has been, you know, part of its algorithm, part of its entire utility is to direct you to kind of accurate and useful information. So Google sort of has been trying to fight spam and fraud and essentially lies for some time. Facebook kind of has a different mission, which mm-hmm. is to connect people and connect you to the world. And I don't think it has as much or has had as long an interest in something like accuracy. Not to say that it has actively kind of pushed fake news, but just part of its culture and the way that it works. I don't think that they have thought about this as big a problem as others have until recently.
Yeah, and it was interesting. Mark Zuckerberg, he put out obviously a Facebook post on this very topic saying that, you know, he doesn't want to start trafficking and deciding what is the truth. But at the same time, BuzzFeed is reporting that some Facebook employees have created an unofficial internal Facebook task force to either like if the boss isn't going to do it, maybe we need to start doing it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's really surprising, actually. You don't usually hear about in Silicon Valley tech companies, you don't usually hear about sort of internal dissidents. Yeah, that doesn't really happen very much. They're usually sort of they go along with the corporate line. I think what's unusual here is that, I mean, a couple things to keep in mind. Everyone in Silicon Valley essentially is a, was a Hillary Clinton supporter. It's very difficult to find anybody who works at Facebook or who works at Google or any of the other big companies who were Trump supporters. This sort of suggests, like, speaks to this larger bubble question. And so I would assume, and even before the election, we had heard sort of rumblings that, you know, people within Facebook had been worried about or been talking about the potential for Facebook to the role that it played in the campaign and in election news. And so I think, you know, people at Facebook probably feel strongly about the election, and they probably feel that Zuckerberg's response was somewhat dismissive. He said something like he didn't think that fake news on Facebook, you know, had a big effect on the election.
Yeah, he said it was like less than 1% or something of what gets shared, but that's pretty powerful. Yeah. 1%. So Farhad, let's take some calls, okay?
Sure.
Our number, by the way, here is 212-433-WNYC. You can tweet us your comment at WNYC. And our question is, how are you dealing with all the tweets, the texts, and posts coming at you right now? Are you shutting it all off or deciding to swim in all the information? And Abdul, you are calling from Rockaway in New Jersey, I think.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. One of the things that I think is that I've noticed happening is that people indulge in vulgar and racist comments openly attacking minorities like Latinos, Muslims, Blacks in their posts and comments. And I feel like it's really easy for people to do that because it's online, so they're not really visible to the general public. And now I'm beginning to get the feeling that people are getting emboldened by this behavior, and that is actually translating into a lot of hate crime that we get to hear, especially the kind that we are getting to see after the election.
So, Abdul, what are you doing? Are you shutting it off, or do you feel that this is important for you to see it?
I am actually seeing more of it because I think it's important for all of us to realize that this kind of information is useful to tie it to the things that are happening around us. So I'm still looking at that information because it's a good indicator of what's happening around me.
Abdul, thank you so much. Farhad, I think what Abdul is talking about is something that you mentioned in one of your pieces where you talked about the Overton window, which is the range of subjects. I had never heard this sociological term before. Mm-hmm. This is the range of subjects that we deem sort of publicly acceptable to discuss. I mean, it used to be, there were certain things you just polite.
You didn't say in public.
No, polite, right. Company did not. It was not acceptable. And now, what do you think it is? People feel safe, maybe even empowered behind a keyboard?
I think there are a few reasons. So it starts because there are some racists in the world and they feel no prohibition against expressing their racism online. But I think that there's this sort of feedback loop where, like, if you harbor some sort of socially unacceptable views, but you keep them to yourself because you don't want other people to judge you. And then you go on Facebook and you see, hey, 3 of my 10 friends are sort of saying the same thing that I think. Maybe it's not such a big deal if I express that. And so you get this license online. There's also the other thing online is, on Twitter, it's anonymous. So you can say anything without repercussions. Facebook requires you to use a real name, but even there, people feel relatively safe because, they're within communities they think, they think they're safe to say those in. So what happens, I think, is that the more that people see the stuff online, I think Abdul is right. It does embolden people. It gives them a sense that, it's okay. It's okay to be racist, and lots of other people think the way I do. So maybe this is just sort of this is the changing country, and we're mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, it gives people that license.
Let's hear from Alyssa, who is calling us from Brooklyn. Hey, Alyssa.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Tell us what's going on.
So I had been a Facebook user for about 9 years. I joined because, I share pictures of the kids and everything with the family. And then the last couple of weeks leading up to the election, I had to deactivate my account because I just couldn't take all the anxiety leading up to the election from my fellow Hillary supporters. It was just too nerve-wracking to think about what would happen if Trump won. And then I deactivated, but then the night of the election, I reactivated it because I desperately needed a community at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it served that purpose for a short term. But then when you start seeing people from the other side, calling our side crybabies and just demeaning what we were experiencing, it was really too hard to handle. And since the last week, I've deactivated and reactivated several times, but last night was the final straw. I saw something from the other side that I just couldn't stomach, and it's not healthy for me. I know where my limits are, and I'd rather focus that attention on things I can actually control instead of being part of this either echo chamber on my side or be exposed to the vitriol from the other side. It was the right choice for me.
Wow. Well, I applaud you for knowing your own limits. So cheers to that, Alyssa. I want to go to Darlene, who is calling us from Ansonia, Connecticut. Darlene, what's your take? How are you handling it?
You know what? I used to, watch a lot of different things on social media when Trump, first was running. And I noticed, I live in Connecticut, but I'm originally from the Bronx, New York. And I grew up in a neighborhood that was basically a lot of Irish, Italian people. And so there was black people there, but not so many of us. And I noticed when this election happened that a lot of people that were on my friends list that were white, were saying things that were so negative about black and Hispanics. And, I was just sitting here like, wait a minute, one of these people I dated, another person here, we all grew up together and you felt this way. Mm. And I was starting to see wow, I got really insulted. And then before I said, I was starting to delete people. But then I said to myself, I like to see this information because I want to see where this is going to go now that he's president. Because, to me, to be honest with you, with social media, mm-hmm. I feel that the Trump presidency was no different than the Obama presidency. It just woke up a lot of white people to vote, just like Obama woke up a lot of black people to vote. Mm. And I didn't vote. I never was a registered voter because I just felt like the voting didn't matter. I was taught that it went through electoral college and it didn't matter half the time because there's nothing happening.
Wait, wait, that's fascinating to me. So you decided not to vote. You saw all this sort of hatred online. You decided not to vote, though. Did you get any messages through Facebook, political messages urging you to vote or for a particular candidate or party?
People were telling me that I need to vote because it mattered. Black people on the other end of my poll were like, oh, you need to vote because if we have Trump in office, we're all going to go through slavery again. That was really what's being, you know, put on as propaganda on social media. So, I never was compelled to vote for Hillary. I never felt compelled to vote for Trump or at all for anyone, not even Obama.
Will you vote next time?
Would I vote next time? It depends on who the candidate is. I never was compelled to vote because I still see the same social injustice happening over and over again. Somebody gets shot that's black, we all march, we sing, and we preach, and we post stuff on Facebook, change our profile pictures, and yet there's still the same stuff happening over and over again. It's to the point that, you know, I feel that at this point with Trump being in office, I think it's a perfect opportunity for people to start uniting and making changes on their own, in their own community, instead of waiting on people to be elected.
Darlene,
tell us what to do.
Thank you so much, Darlene. I really appreciate it. So, I mean, Farhad, here we have Alyssa, who's like, this is it. I've reached my limit. I am out. Yeah. Sorry, Facebook. And then you've got Darlene, who also is like, I'm out, but she's staying on Facebook and looking and wants to see it all. I mean, what's your take on that? Because let's just remember, at the end of the day, Facebook and all these other platforms, they want us to feel riled up about the issues. They don't want us to quit like Alyssa did, but they want us to be engaged and spend more time posting and linking and reading and seeing ads and making them money, right?
Yeah. I think that they suggest sort of the entire dilemma of this, which is, do you want a feed that makes you feel good and not anxious and sort of and the way to do that is to have a feed that perhaps sort of mirrors your views, or if it does show you something from, you know, the other side politically, it might be something kind of dumb so you can sort of easily dismiss it. Or do you want a feed that presents kind of a diverse view, but that makes you feel really bad? And that's the reason why Facebook doesn't do that. I mean, no one who wants you to use their product wants to make you feel bad all the time.
Right.
And so this is the difficulty for Facebook, which is, you know, they want you, as you said, they want you to be engaged. And that usually means to show you something that you're likely to like. And for a lot of people, that usually means, you know, show you news that reflects your views and sort of your worldview and doesn't really contradict, you know, your sort of deep held beliefs about the world. And I think that's the difficulty here.
So I want to ask you then. So, you know, there are some people who are saying that actually these platforms had a huge role in the outcome of the election. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, what is the power of social media on politics or real action? We saw Twitter's role in protests in the Middle East, but we can hardly say that democracy has spread there as a result. Is it to inflame or incite? But where's the follow through? I'm curious to know where you think we are.
I don't think we have a good answer because there have been sort of different effects in different places. Mm-hmm. I think in the US, I mean, I tend to think that Mark Zuckerberg is right that fake news wasn't the thing that changed the outcome of the election. You can point to sort of it whatever effect that was, it was probably small compared to, you know, like James Comey's announcement or various other sort of big things in the news. I do think that it's pretty clear that Donald Trump was able to get his views out and get a platform, especially early in the campaign, by using Twitter and by sort of cultivating or tapping into a very powerful group of people online, an organization. You know, we now talk about it as the alt-right, but it's basically like Breitbart readers, people who are very active online, and they, you know, amplified his message. And that sort of amplification on Twitter fed into the reason why, you know, cable news booked him so often, because he was just very popular. I think the whole sort of structure worked worked well for him. And so in this case, I think that he was able to use social media, especially Twitter, as a way to tap into kind of the mainstream media. And, you know, he also used it to raise a lot of money. I mean, this is a tactic that Howard Dean pioneered, and, you know, Obama really took mainstream. And this year, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump used the internet to raise a lot of money. And that, you know, also had a hugely powerful effect. In other countries and other places, the effects are different. As you mentioned, the Arab Spring, it got a lot of activists involved and got people out into the street, but it didn't seem to have long-term effects on sort of governance and the, you know, actual, you know, how those countries changed and the kind of institutions afterward. But I think that for sort of short-term campaigns, especially that involve a lot of media, like this also happened in Brexit in the United Kingdom,
right?
It really can change politics, especially for groups that are that don't have much access to the media in the first place. You know, the alt-right, white supremacist types did not have much access at all to the mainstream media a year and a half or 2 years ago. But thanks to Twitter and thanks to Donald Trump's tapping into that group, they now do. I mean, they have a seat at the White House. So,
all right, Farhad, don't go anywhere, okay? We're going to come right back. You are listening to a special post-election live call-in episode of The United States of Anxiety. This is WNYC's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. I'm Anoush Samarodi, and we're going to be back with more of your calls right after this.
This is a special post-election call-in episode of The United States of Anxiety, WNYC in the nation's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. You can hear the entire United States of Anxiety series at wnyc.org/anxiety and leave a comment letting us know what's on your mind during this divisive time. United States of Anxiety is also available as a podcast. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or on the WNYC app.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
You're listening to a special post-election live call-in episode of The United States of Anxiety. This is WNYC's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. I'm Anoush Samarodi. I'm the host of the tech podcast Note to Self from WNYC Studios. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Also, I want to thank Farhad Manju, the New York Times tech columnist, who is here. And we both want to hear from you how you're dealing with post-election information overload and social media. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can tweet your comment at WNYC. And there's a tweet from Stephen Licardi. He says, "I continue to wade through the fodder because I believe we must identify the common ground over against anger, ignorance, hate." So he wants to see what's out there. Kirsten Wyatt tweeted us and said she's wondering if bringing back the chronological timeline on Facebook might help get us out of our online bubbles. This is a good question, Farhad. Right now, it feels like these feeds are dividing us. Can these same platforms bring us together? Have you figured out any ways they could maybe do this?
If I did, I maybe would be working at one of those companies. I think it's a difficult thing because, I mean, as I said, they don't have much interest in showing you a diverse feed. And I'm not sure. I think that's what people say they want, but really, I don't think that that's what people want. I mean, I hear all the time from people who are like, I saw this crazy Trump person in my feed and I ignored him, or my friend or cousin or someone is supporting Trump and I unfollowed him. Like, that happens all the time. So I'm not sure people want a diverse feed. I think the more difficult thing for Facebook is that even if they sort of fixed this filter bubble problem, and even if they fixed the fake news problem, their premise is that connecting people around the world, connecting 2 billion people, will create this very, very sort of powerful force. And I think we're seeing that. I mean,
that's for sure.
I
want to hear Sloan from Connecticut. I think she's a parent. I'm wondering what she's thinking. Hi, Sloan. Thanks for calling us.
I usually get that all the time, that no, it's the guy's name.
Oh, hello. Either way is fine.
I wanted to say two things. The first thing being, I think largely social media is largely ineffective to change people's minds. I think once they're on it, it's very difficult to get people to change their minds, and you get into these arguments that can kind of go to nowhere. And the second thing that I'm using social media for now, and I haven't really used it in the past, but this election has changed what I need to do coming from the perspective of being a parent.
Mm.
And what I'm trying to use social media for is to gather the like-minded people that have the same viewpoints to make sure that our children are going to grow up in a community that is in protecting them from incidents of hate and intolerance. I think what we're seeing a lot in our communities all over the country, in Connecticut as well, is schools with isolated incidents of speech, of graffiti. There have been many upsetting things. So one of the things that I'm trying to do as a parent is to gather the people that I know who will not accept this in our communities. And as leaders, we can help change the face of within our community. And I think it has to start there.
Sloan, thank you. So harnessing the powers of these platforms for organizing, for good. Did you want to say something? Go ahead, Farhad.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I actually have talked to people for whom that has worked really well. I read an article a few months ago about parents of transgender children.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, you know, it's such a small community that they didn't have anyone else to talk to about, you know, the parents didn't, the children didn't. And thanks to Facebook, there's entire communities now in different areas, and they get together regularly, and it has changed their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because it's sort of the same power of connecting people who, you know, are in various ways minorities, and showing them that they have this community.
That's a beautiful thing. Okay, so let's go to Jen in Monmouth County. Hi, Jen. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. What's on your mind?
So I chose not to unfriend or unfollow anyone on my Facebook feed due to their political views, because unlike Twitter, I know everyone in my Facebook circle personally, and many of those who were sharing Trump-supporting messages were members of my extended family. And especially after the Trump tapes surfaced, myself and there were members of my family who knew this, that I am a sexual assault survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And to see them posting just really vitriolic and really hateful things after the tapes emerged, sort of excusing it, downplaying it, and victim blaming was really hard for me. And it occurs to me that, like, thanks to social media now, I know these things about some of these members of my extended family, whereas in previous times I might not. Like, I might not know my cousin Justin's view on sexual assault or Donald Trump or things like that. And I am very conflicted as to whether, like, what to do with this information, because if I drop out, then I also don't get to see his kid win the county science fair,
right,
or stuff
right,
like that.
Right.
So this enmeshing of my family and my political stances, and it's sort of like it's impossible to disentangle. And so I've chosen to sort of face it unblinkingly and to not unfriend or unfollow or unfilter. I consciously changed my timeline to the chronological one.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of these efforts to not be in my bubble, to be in, like, I don't live in the red state where I grew up anymore. So I try really hard, not just through continuing to be a part of my family, but just sort of how I curate my feed, not to do that. But it can be, like, very traumatic. It seems like the trauma only goes one way. Like, I'm trying to imagine a situation where it's in reverse, but I can't. And so it's just this, I mean, it's a great place in that I can see, like, oh, so-and-so is acting.
Oh, Jen, I know exactly what you're saying. I think so many people listening right now really empathize with the frustration, the struggle, the conscious decision making that that these platforms are putting on all of us. I want to thank, first of all of you who there's so many people called in. We could keep going. Thank you for telling us what you are personally doing. I really appreciate that. Farhad, we're gonna transition to a different topic on technology. But before you go, I just want to ask you quickly. Can you just tell me more about how, very quickly, I know this is hard, how Silicon Valley is reacting to Donald Trump's election? I mean, California is solidly blue. The Valley is almost like navy blue. Are you starting to hear conversations about how isolated tech leaders are from the rest of the country? What the sort of responsibility the people making these platforms have to their users?
Not in any coherent way. I think a lot of people here, in the same way as in the rest of the country, are very still very kind of emotional and stunned. And so I haven't heard any kind of coherent response about that. I mean, I think people do recognize that it is somewhat problematic, or maybe very problematic, that these companies are building products that are being used globally, but they're mainly built by, you know, a few people in California who are pretty much the same. And also that the kind of the thing that the products do mostly is, you know, the core goal of a lot of these products is to kind of replace, you know, human work with computers. And mm-hmm. so it causes kind of economic disruption also. And so I think this is a long term, both a political and in some ways a moral problem for Silicon Valley.
Right.
And they are sort of only beginning to deal with it. They had the Valley had a kind of a you know, 8 years where they sort of got a pass, like mostly people in the Obama administration and in most of the rest of the country were on the technology side. And now the technology is kind of changing the world in really big ways. And there's both a lot of good and a lot of bad coming out of it. I think that the climate for the tech industry is changing and people in the tech industry don't quite know how to respond to it yet.
Farhad Manjoo is the New York Times tech columnist. Farhad, thank you so much for being with us. I think you have to go like put your kids to bed or something. So thank you. I appreciate it.
That's right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye. You are listening to the United States of Anxiety. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. And we're going to turn now to another aspect of technology and its effect on how we live and how we vote. So this week, the current head of the National Security Agency, the NSA, he is also the commander of U.S. Cyber Command. He pretty much accused Russia of using WikiLeaks to get Donald Trump elected. Here's Admiral Michael S. Rogers on stage at a Wall Street Journal conference.
There shouldn't be any doubt in anybody's mind. This was not something that was done casually. This was not something that was done by chance. This was not a target that was selected purely arbitrarily. This was a conscious effort by a nation state to attempt to achieve a specific effect.
Thanks to those hackers, whoever they may be, we were privy to some incredibly intimate, sometimes silly, sometimes quite serious political emails. I mean, I, for one, felt deeply uncomfortable reading Chelsea Clinton's tips to her mother about how they should upgrade the State Department's website. We want encryption to protect our bank accounts, to protect our emails, our national infrastructure and utilities. But this new president also campaigned on a promise of law and order, and there are many, many digital methodologies at his disposal. And so we want to ask you, what are your anxieties about digital surveillance in a Trump administration? What concerns you more? Is it a future terrorist attack or the potential demise of some of your civil liberties? That those might have to be sacrificed in the process of keeping us safe. Please call us. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. You can tweet your comments or questions or whatever at WNYC. But before we go to your calls, I want to talk privacy, surveillance, and our safety online and off, and how those two things might change once Donald Trump takes office with an expert. Mark Rotenberg is president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy and open government law at Georgetown University Law Center. He frequently testifies before Congress on civil liberties issues, and he joins us via Skype from Paris. Hello, Mark. Thanks so much for being here in the middle of your night.
Hi, Manoush. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to hear your voice.
Good to hear yours.
Okay, so Donald Trump ran on a campaign promise of law and order. Just so we understand fully, I mean, we all have, you know, cell phones and Facebook accounts, but in the digital era, what are some of the tools that will potentially be at his disposal to enforce that promise of law and order?
Well, I mean, the most simple way to think about it, of course, is, you know, legal claims that people might bring. There's a law and order approach that's actually in defense of privacy and defense of liberty. And I wouldn't necessarily assume that it's a lock 'em up approach to law and order, although it may quickly become that. And if that's the domain we're in, then let's just talk for a moment what that type of, you know, lock 'em up approach starts to look like. Part of it, of course, would be the growing problem in the United States of massive incarceration. There were efforts in the last Congress with President Obama and on a bipartisan basis to try to reduce the imprisonment of Americans, which seemed long overdue. So before we jump into the electronic surveillance issues, I think it's probably worth noting that it's going to take a lot of work to keep that effort to reduce the level of incarceration in the United States on track. But as long as we're talking electronic surveillance, I think there are two big categories. One is about private communications and the ability of the government through wiretap law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, to intercept and capture private communications using also national security letters. The other big area of interest to EPIC that doesn't receive quite as much of attention, but we think may be as important, if not more important, are the growing number of government databases, particularly within the Department of Justice and the NSA and elsewhere, that give federal agencies these enormously detailed profiles on Americans. And it's a particular database of the FBI that has us concerned. It's called the Next Generation Identification Biometric System. Basically, it is the way in which the FBI identifies and tracks people across the country. We decided this week to file a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Bureau because we're particularly concerned about the potential misuse of that database. So in brief, incarceration is obviously the big issue, but on the electronic privacy front, we're looking at both interception of communications and the use of data stored in government databases.
So, Mark, let's take a call. I think Eric is calling from Westchester County with a question. Hey, Eric, it's Manoush here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Manoush. Yes, I can. Thank you.
Go ahead.
My question is, early on in the process, I was happy about Trump. I might have said some things online I might have regretted. Now that he's elected, he has power. Can he go back and look at what we were saying a year ago, 9 months ago, and then put pressure on us today?
This is a good question. Eric, thank you. So, Mark, I mean, when it comes to individuals being targeted, Eric's wondering, is it possible?
Well, I think Eric is making a very good point. One of the issues that civil liberties organizations, including EPIC, have begun to focus on is the government monitoring of social media. I talked a moment ago about intercepting private communication. But of course, a lot of what we do online nowadays is visible to others. We want it to be visible. We're posting on Facebook, we're organizing, we're protesting, and we're tweeting. And so we've been interested in whether the government is actually collecting that data and perhaps even, you know, tracking people, targeting people based on what they're posting online. EPIC had an open government lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security a few years ago where we actually uncovered the manual of the words that the DHS used to track tweets, and we learned from the manual that we obtained that the agency was trying to identify not only risks to public safety, which I guess is appropriate, but also criticisms of the agency. And that's actually kind of creepy if you think about it, a federal agency with that kind of surveillance authority tracking people who might be criticizing what the agency is doing.
Yeah, especially since on the campaign trail, also Trump floated the idea of keeping a database of Muslims and surveilling mosques. So in terms of like legal protections that are in place to protect people from being targeted or tracked, that does that go back to the Privacy Act of like 1974?
Yeah, very good. So the Privacy Act is one of the laws that Epic is planning to, you know, really spend some time with in the next few years. In part because we see that as one of the crucial legal frameworks that limits the ability of government agencies to build detailed profiles on citizens. And it's probably also the right moment for me to point out that many of these privacy laws have a strong bipartisan tradition. That law in 1974 was co-sponsored by Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts, the liberal, and conservative Barry Goldwater from Arizona. And I think it's important for people to keep in mind that, you know, privacy and civil liberties in this country have long been nonpartisan issues. They should be nonpartisan issues. And to the extent that we face new challenges, you know, we'll be looking for allies across the spectrum.
So stand by here. You are listening to a special post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. I'm Anoush Samarodi, and we'll be back with more of your calls after this.
This is a special post-election call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC and the nation's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. You can hear the entire United States of Anxiety series at WNYC.org/anxiety and leave a comment letting us know what's on your mind during this divisive time. United States of Anxiety is also available as a podcast. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or on the WNYC app.
This is a special post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. I'm Anoush Samarodi, and we are talking privacy and the future of our digital lives with Mark Rottenberg. He is head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC. We are also taking your calls. What are your anxieties about digital surveillance and privacy right now? Please call us at 212-433-WNYC or 212-433-9692. You can tweet us at WNYC. Mark, let's take a call from Ayub. I think he wants to talk specifically about Muslims under surveillance. Hi, Ayub.
Hi, Anoush. Great program.
Thank you.
Yeah, my point is I'm a Muslim and for 8 years under an ally, quote-unquote, I mean, Barack Obama, who is here, that was, well, closer to us a little bit. But we were under surveillance. It started under Bush administration. So who would doubt that the Trump administration will not do more than what Bush and Obama did in order to have Muslim under constant surveillance, and it is a bit frightening for me.
Thank you so much, Ayub. I mean, I think that is a great question, Mark. Are we, you know, God forbid there is another incident, whether it's terrorism or any other security threat, what will it take for people to think, you know what, if this is what we've got to do, it's what we've got to do to protect ourselves?
Well, you know, I remember, Manoush, very well the days after 9/11. I mean, we go back, you know, almost 15 years now, more than 15 years, in fact. And there was a remarkable coming together at that moment in time with civil liberties organizations and civil rights organizations and the Muslim organizations. And we stood together. In fact, we created a coalition in the fall of 2001 called In Defense of Freedom. One of the messages that we tried to convey was that we had a common interest in protecting basic rights in America. And, you know, I don't think we're yet at that point. I'm very careful about not letting our advocacy get ahead of where the political circumstance may be. But I think it is important to keep in mind that if we do reach that point, we certainly have the experience and we certainly have worked together as we did in the early years of President Bush's administration, to protect the rights of individuals and do so by bringing people together. And I think it will happen again, actually. It gives me some hope, having been a part of that earlier effort.
Let's go to Keith. He is calling from Shirley, New York. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Tell me what you're thinking about.
So I was just wondering your thoughts. I was told by a professor at Pace University that we should be more concerned about the private sector selling information to the government. And I know that Disney has one of the largest databases of fingerprints in the world. I was just wondering your opinions on that.
Such a great question, Keith. I think, we hear this idea of the surveillance economy, all these companies making money off of watching our every move, tracking everywhere we go. Mark, what do you think about that?
Yes, well, it's a very good point. It's something that EPIC has been focused on pretty much from the start. The problems really fall in two categories. I mean, first is that the companies are commercializing our personal information. They take that data, they disclose it to others. It's not necessarily a sale, by the way. People say that sometimes, companies will say, well, we're not actually selling your data, but of course, they're profiling you and tracking you and using it for advertising purposes, which is just as bad. But the other problem is that increasingly the private sector is doing the data gathering work of the government surveillance agencies, which is precisely what Snowden disclosed when he obtained the documents about the PRISM program. And that's a whole series of activities under which the government was able to obtain detailed internet transaction records and cell phone records and email records from the internet firms. And then, of course, we have many private sector companies, data brokers and others that routinely sell their data to the FBI and others. So we've been arguing for a long time, actually, the United States needs a comprehensive privacy law. We need it in part to limit the commercial exploitation of personal data, but we also need it to reinforce the firewall between the private sector and the federal government.
If you have anxieties about digital surveillance in a Trump administration, please call us. Our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Tweet us at WNYC. And let's go to Deborah. She's calling from Newark, New Jersey. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hello. I'm even more concerned about what will happen with surveillance in a Trump administration than what happened under the Bush administration. We've elected for president a man steeped in conspiratorial thinking, and even more than government surveillance of individuals, my concern is that we're going to be moved into a world where we will be encouraged to spy on each other and report on each other.
Yeah, you're not the only one who has said something like that, Deborah. Mark, are Deborah's concerns warranted at this point? I mean, it's kind of funny to think about this idea of someone who, Donald Trump himself last night, the family ditched the press corps and went to the 21 Club, and they didn't tell anyone. So this idea of transparency and tracking goes both ways, I guess. But
it does, absolutely. And that's a really good point, by the way, because, the flip side of protecting the privacy of people is ensuring the transparency of government. And I think we need to focus on both equally. In other words, in a democratic government, we expect our leaders to make decisions in a way that the people understand and can hold the leaders accountable. And that should certainly continue. I thought your caller made a good point, actually. There's a phrase that we live with since 9/11. It's plastered all over New York City. You see it in the metro stations and the train stations. It's, if you see something, say something. I've always been a little uncomfortable about that phrase. A lot of times it's led people to report on activities of other people who, appear different or are not acting in ways that someone doesn't necessarily understand. I do think we have to keep a check on that worldview. It is a way to get people to begin to spy on one another, and I don't think it's, a part of our tradition or culture.
No. I think Johnny in Brooklyn has a question for you, Mark. Hey, Johnny.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
my question is regarding the surveillance program, and I wanted to know if the Trump administration would come into power, how far can they go into surveillancing of Muslims? Could they even actually put trackers on us?
Great question. Johnny? Sorry, Mark, what do you think about Johnny's question? Trackers. Well, I mean, trackers take many forms, right?
Absolutely. And of course, we had a Supreme Court case just a couple of years ago about GPS devices that police had installed on vehicles. The Supreme Court, I think, in a very good decision, said that the police needed an actual judicial warrant before they could engage in that surveillance. But what was remarkable after the court decision was that we learned that there were several thousand vehicles in the United States that had these tracking devices installed by the police without judicial authority. So that program had really gone pretty far along. I think in the area of oversight and accountability, we're going to be looking, you know, to certain key institutions. One will certainly be the Congress. And I know people are concerned because the majorities in the House and the Senate are the same political party as the president. But nonetheless, congressional committees will have an obligation to do oversight of the federal agencies. And I think that's a very important opportunity for the public to weigh in about these issues. And we're also going to look to the courts because the judiciary remains a key bastion for the protection of rights of individuals when the president oversteps. And the judges, in fact, and particularly in times like this, become even more important to protect privacy and open government.
But I'm curious, Mark, just a couple weeks ago, the FCC passed consumer privacy protections that require internet providers to ask before they collect and sell their users' data. So, you know, if you connect the internet to your house, that means that person providing you with the internet needs to tell you, needs to let you know and ask you if it's okay, if they monitor everything, if they watch what you're taking in and out and then sell it. What's going to happen there?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, we had actually proposed a much stronger framework for privacy protection. But even with a modest proposal that the commission voted on, there is now some concern that it, you know, could be effectively rescinded. I hope that doesn't happen. And I hope, again, that people understand there really is a common interest in protecting the privacy of people who use new telecommunication services. But, of course, there's also a backup plan. And the backup plan is that increasingly people will be using encryption, they'll be using Tor, they'll be using VPN to try to provide some confidentiality for their personal communications.
You're listening to a special post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety. My name is Manoush Zomorodi. I'm the host of Note to Self here at WNYC. I'm talking to Mark Rottenberg of Epic. Let's take a call from Will. He's in Westchester. Hey, Will.
Hey, the point I wanted to make was that there's a more fundamental issue underlying all of this, and that is that law enforcement is operating on the basic theory of if we watch a lot of stuff and filter out the good guys, we can catch the bad guys. And that might work sometimes if the bad guys are stupid. But for anyone who is even moderately well-informed, there is publicly available, long-known, unbreakable, even by NSA and the FBI, ways to encrypt your communications. So in grabbing as much as they possibly can, law enforcement is going to come up with a bunch of stuff, and in there might be communications from terrorists or bad folks, but only from really stupid terrorists or bad folks. The bad folks and terrorists who know what they're doing aren't going to be catchable that way. And so when law enforcement is asking for more authority to break into this and break into that and collect this and collect that, their motivation is ill-based and kind of pointless, and it's what Bruce Schneier calls security theater to a very great extent.
Well, thank you so much. Bruce, what do you think? Is Will right that they – sorry, Mark, what do you think? Is Will right – so many names. Is Will right that actually, you know, you don't catch bad guys by breaking through encryption? I mean, this debate sort of played out a few months ago when the FBI wanted to unlock the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone. Trump said he supported forcing Apple to write software that would have let the government have access. This is bound to come up again.
Well, it is. And, you know, to be clear, Epic has been on the front lines of defending the rights of Internet users to use encryption. We supported Apple in the dispute with the FBI, and I actually debated the FBI director, Mr. Comey, on this issue back in August. I'll say something a little bit controversial, though. I do, you know, respect and understand the important role that law enforcement has in protecting public safety and identifying genuine risks. I don't think we should ignore that. But at the same time, I feel even more strongly that we need an independent basis to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of these techniques and also to determine whether there's misuse. So if the Bureau or any other federal agency says they need new surveillance authority, I think we need to find a way to make sure that there's adequate oversight. And if the programs are not working as they're supposed to work, then I think they should be shut down. I think that's the basic bargain here. And the problem is that many of these programs undertaken without adequate oversight, the public is given reassurances that they're necessary to pursue, but that's just not sufficient.
I mean, I think it makes us feel better, right? It makes us feel a little bit more empowered that we can do something. We can get in there and get the information we need. And it's almost like a marketing tactic in a way.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that's also why Bruce used the phrase security theater. That was back in the days, of course, where we had these crazy airport body scanners that were, you know, viewing everybody naked before they got on the plane. And the government said, well, this was absolutely necessary, you know, to protect us and travel safety. And of course, it turned out not to be. There were much less intrusive ways to check people before they got on planes for explosives. But the key point here, as I said, I think there really needs to be pushback from the public. And I think this also has to come, you know, across the political spectrum. There are a lot of people who voted for President Trump who I think are understandably concerned about what might happen if there's not adequate oversight. And we're going to need them involved in these debates as well.
I want to thank all the people who are waiting have called in. We can't take all your questions. I am so sorry, but thank you for expressing your opinion. And Mark, just before we go, though, I feel like there's one sort of urgent thing we need to ask you. Do you think that there are some people who need to start using encryption or privacy tools? Would you recommend certain people do this, or is that fear-mongering?
Well, you know, I really do believe the protection of civil liberties and privacy is a common undertaking in this country. I don't think particular groups should feel targeted. And I think to the extent that one person needs to use encryption, I think we should all use encryption. But I also believe that we should have the protections in law that respect the privacy of our communications. You know, this actually goes back to Benjamin Franklin. He gets the Pony Express underway so that he can move mail around the country. And then he helps get the first privacy law through the U.S. Congress. Because he recognizes the importance of protecting confidentiality. It's a very big part of the American tradition, and I think we need to defend it and extend it, you know, in the years ahead.
Mark Rotenberg, the head of Epic, thank you so much for staying up into the early hours in Paris to be with us.
Nice speaking with you.
You have been listening to a special post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety. This is WNYC's election series that is documenting the experiences, the perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. We've been talking technology and privacy, how it affected our election, could change everything in the coming months as well. My thanks again to Mark Rotenberg, the head of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and Farhad Manju, tech columnist for the New York Times. And many thanks to you for listening and sharing your thoughts with me and everyone else tonight on WNYC. Our call-in series continues tomorrow night, all this week, at 8 p.m. here on WNYC. You can find the United States of Anxiety right on our homepage at WNYC.org. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and if you had some fun, learned something tonight, and you want to hang out with me more, notetoselfradio.org is the place to go. Thank you so much for having me, and good night.